Our next speaker is Frank Gordon, and he got his doctorate in engineering from the University of Kansas back in 71. After that, he served 38 years with the U.S. Navy, and during that time, while running Star Wars out in the West Coast, he managed to carve out a whole field of cold fusion with Stan Spock and Larry Forsley, Pam Boss, and we will hear about what he's learned about co-deposition. Do you want this for yours? You should plug it in there.
I think I'll just use this. I can see if I can just...
Okay, well, thank you, Mitchell. And this, I'd like to start out with thanking Mitchell again for organizing this. It's having been a co-chair for one of the ICCFs. I can't imagine one person doing this and doing it again and again and again. Some of us are faster learners than that, I guess. But anyhow, I also want to compliment you on organizing it at Spring here in Boston. 2 weeks ago when I was preparing this, this is what I thought it would say. I think we've got one more on the way before Spring. A year ago at this time, I think Boston got hit. And I put this next slide in for David French. One time I was talking to him, and he said it was cold just a figure of speech. So, in any event, it takes some of you a little longer to catch. So on with the presentation. The previous presentation actually was an ideal lead-in to what I would hope to say, and I guess the conclusion of what I'm going to say is probably going to lead to more discussion rather than conclusions. The benefit of these types of conferences typically is the opportunity to meet one-on-one and in small groups and talk about things, and I'm hoping that that's what this presentation leads to. So the summary is, you know, a wide variety of co-deposition protocols have been used, and we just heard about another one. Magnetic, electric fields, ultrasonic fields, other forms of stimulation seem to be important. Fukai is a name that a lot of you probably haven't heard of, and I'm going to talk about some work he's done. He's a material scientist and did not know he was doing what cold fusion work at the time he did his work, and then the implication to these results. The evolution of co-deposition starting in 89 when Pons and Fleischmann did their result. Mike McCubery has a statement that says, any scientist worth his salt always has a better idea. They never follow what the other person did, and that was certainly the case with Stan Spock. He thought immediately that the better idea was co-deposition. In fact, while everyone else was out finding palladium rods or wires to do the experiment, Stan found some palladium chloride and did a co-deposition experiment, the first experiments that were done at the Navy lab, and for a long time, continued to work with that. Many others have used co-deposition, and I haven't attempted to list all of them. But I do want to focus in later on some work, recent work by Letson Hagelstein. Was actually published in JCM&S in 2012, and was presented, parts of it, at ICCF 17 in Korea. I didn't pick up on the significance of it until just recently, what I think is significance. This was one of the first co-deposition experiments that we did in San Diego with Pam Boss and Stan Spock. Took some palladium chloride, an electrode, a couple of thermocouples, And after very few minutes, you can see that the solution warmed up and was warmer the cathode was warmer than the solution. So this was not something that should happen. If you have Joule heatings, clearly the solution should warm up faster. And so this was evidence that the heat was being produced at the cathode. We did not attempt to do precision calorimetry in San Diego. We just didn't spend the time doing that, but did a lot of work for just measuring the cathode. Also, here when we turned the experiment off, we saw the temperature rise on the metal and the cathode, and then the solution followed. This was the heat after death that Flashman talked about, and we were able to see that. This was published in Journal Electrochemical Analysis in 1991. One of the other experiments we did a few years later was an IR examination of the cathode as it was going, and you can see, now this is in real time, so you can see in a matter of a few seconds how much the cathode was heating up, and Dave Nagel did some later analysis based on the size and the time and all that, and concluded that these had to be nuclear events that were causing this kind of heat production. We showed these results to Lowell Wood from Lawrence Livermore Lab, and he said, hey, you guys are in the Navy, you should put a transducer in there, because if these are little mini explosions, you should hear them. We, again, being scientists, thought we had a better idea, and that was to take the piezoelectric and ferroelectric material and co-deposit right on to that. And when we did, we were able to see pressure spikes followed by a thermal increase in you know, piezo or pyroelectric materials, both piezo and pyro sensitive, and so it would measure both the pressure and also the temperature. When we looked at the different surfaces, you know, here's the co-deposition without the magnetic electric field. When we applied an electric field, we saw some different morphology, and a magnetic field clearly showed a different morphology. One of the features of co-deposition was it gives us a possibility or opportunity to really check and see what's happening with a lot of things. And these results, again, were published in 2005 and 2007, although the work was done fairly early in the 90s. When I talked to Stan about what are the electrochemical processes involved, the typical protocol that we have used in San Diego involves to start out with a very low current density. And the reason is you want to be below the diffusion limiting current. This is to give us a nice solid deposition or plating out so that we get good adhesion. Then we raise the current above the diffusion limiting current, and now you start seeing evolution of hydrogen or deuterium. And as it continues to plate out, the palladium chloride or nickel chloride in the solution is plated out. And ultimately, now this is really an exponential curve that goes on out, but ultimately it gets down where the solution clears, and then we typically raise the current level to stabilize the material on the electrode. So this is the process that we've used. And we've been primarily focusing on nuclear products. You know, one of the questions was, you know, prove it's nuclear. If someone can prove it's nuclear, then we'll fund it. Remember when one neutron, if they can produce one neutron, that would be enough? You know, this was in 1989 when they were making their comments. Well, and a year ago, we got a patent that on the production of high-energy neutrons. It was actually awarded to the Spey War for producing neutrons. We haven't seen a lot of funding based on that patent. Recently, one of the blogs, I think, in Italy said that the U.S. government has officially recognized coal fusion because they have given a patent for this process. One of the other experiments that we've done is looking at deuterium uptake, and this was published in 1994.
After we do the initial plating, when we raise the current above the diffusion limiting current, within just a few seconds, then we reverse the current and look and determine how much hydrogen had been or deuterium had been deposited at that time, which then came out. And since it takes twice as many electrons to plate a palladium as it does a deuterium, so two-thirds of the energy along this line is, let's say this 8 seconds, would have been plating out palladium, one-third would have been plating out deuterium, and when we reverse the current, we see that we're getting, there's some, where do you really put this second line, but we see that we're getting high loading in just a matter of seconds as we're plating out. Other experiments we did, published this in 99, showed that the excess enthalpy also occurs fairly quickly. Initially it's endothermic, and then very quickly shifts to exothermic, and we see the production going up. So, again, more evidence. I threw the Galileo protocol up here because they decided, hey, if we had an experiment, this was another idea, if we have an experiment that a lot of people can do and they all get good results, then someone will have to recognize that this is valid and we'll all get funded. So the idea was, let's do a protocol that if people follow, they will get results. And so Pam Boss very carefully wrote down a protocol for people to follow, and this was tested with a group of about a half a dozen different people tried it. Now, unfortunately, all of these half a dozen people were scientists, and they all thought they had a better idea, so I don't know how many actually followed the protocol. The interesting thing is, though, most of them got results. And I remember the Littles in Texas put a thing out, a little video on the web. They said they had 7 cells running. They were all producing excess heat. They went straight to a high current level. They didn't start out with a low threshold. And when we had done that, in some of our experiments, we saw, first of all, you don't get very good adhesion. And second, the plating is very mossy. But it's still, they were very excited about it. 2 weeks later, they completely changed for some reason. I guess that's typical. But others saw also, using CR39, saw that they were able to produce particles. And these were people at SRI, Berkeley, several people, Oriani and others all saw evidence of particles in the CR39. So the takeaway here is that co-deposition must be pretty robust, because it's hard to screw it up. Okay, now let me jump to the Letts Hagelstein paper. They tried co-deposition, and Dennis Letts has actually made a very nice calorimeter. Has done a lot of work in this calorimeter, and so they tried the SPOC protocol. Now, 0.3 molar lithium chloride, 0.5 molar O5 palladium chloride, and D2O, following a current profile similar to what Pam had put together in the steps, and I have found out, yes, magnets were used for this experiment, and they did not see excess heat in this experiment. So, now, for reasons known only to Dennis and Peter, they changed the electrodes, they modified, here's the anode, copper substrate on the cathode. They reduced the lithium chloride by a factor of 2. They reduced the palladium chloride by a factor of 40. And rather than starting at a low plating current, they started at 500 milliamps per square centimeter. And when they did that, they saw excess energy and excess heat. So
here's a picture of their cell. They had one electrode here that was their inert electrode, and they used this for calibration. They had a second electrode inside this platinum anode that was the copper foil that then they co-deposited the palladium onto. So the way they did conduct the experiment was for the first 800 minutes they calibrated the Seebeck calorimeter, and they did this with D2O lithium chloride just operating at 500 milliamps per square centimeter, what the current level they're planning to operate. Then at this point they added, and this is really interesting, 0.44 milliliters of palladium chloride that they bought from Sigma Aldrich, 0.5% by weight, 10% HCl, and this was in a water-based solution, light water-based solution. So they actually added light water, not a lot, but light water to the cell. Now this challenges one of the early assumptions, and that was that hydrogen was poison for these experiments. We don't know, but clearly it wasn't in this case, because when they did, what happened was immediately the excess energy went up, it operated state for a while, and then they replaced the D2O with H2O, and it dropped, and then exponentially came back down. A lot of excess heat, very interesting experiment. Again, probably it will lead to more questions than answers. So, important events in the search for excess heat and palladium. You know, we have Spock and Mosher Boss and others showed that co-deposition from palladium and deuterium works in the solution of lithium chloride. In ICCF-15, McCoubery and his co-workers at SRI showed that some conditions must be met to replicate non-splashment excess heat. And this is where, you know, the heavy loading of 0.85 to 0.95, long waiting periods, 2 to 4 weeks. And then in ICCF-17, Peter gave a presentation, talked about something and mentioned the superabundant vacancies, and in one of their experiments they found that one parameter, the only increased by 340% with an increase of 13 degrees in cell temperature, and that was the number of vacancies in the cathode, and the term superabundant vacancies is one that they used. And here's what it is, and this comes from Fukai, was the initial author of this, and then other authors in 2010 published, and this is where I got this drawing. But here's your normal face-centered cubic where you've got the metal lattice, the big face-centered cubic, and then the hydrogen or deuterium in the interstitial sites. And when a superabundant vacancy occurs is when you actually remove the metal hydrogen and or the metal, and so you get a vacancy here. And what can happen in that vacancy is it can actually trap up to 6 deuterium or hydrogen atoms. And you see it here. Here's 1, 2, 3, and there would be 4, 5, 6 on the other side here. And Fukai claims that this is actually a more stable loading than any of the other loadings. So the hydrogen is stable there. So, and based on this, you get a maximum loading ratio of 4 to 3, so 1.33. Now, part of this loading is because we have now removed the metal. So the number of palladium or nickel atoms is reduced. But so you get a maximum loading of 4 to 3. Some of the things, and several of the papers that Fukai wrote, and again, he's a metallurgist or a material scientist. You know, one of the important recognitions is that it's the most stable structure in the metal hydrogen or metal deuterium alloys. In fact, a defect structure containing a large number of vacancies. In all metals investigated by ion implantation experiments, hydrogen ions are trapped in the vacancies, up to six per vacancy, with a really large binding energy. In the metal hydrogen alloys, at high temperature and high hydrogen pressure, lattice parameter of nickel and palladium decreased over several hours to limiting value of minus 1.5% smaller. So, you know, when originally we thought the lattice expanded as we added more hydrogen or more deuterium, Fukai says that when you have superabundant vacancies, it actually contracts some. And there's a possibility of creating SAVs without extreme conditions, mainly electrolytic deposition. Now, you know, the way he was creating with bombardment and all sorts of, you know, stressing of the lattice, and then in one of his papers he says, oh, by the way, with electrolysis and electrolytic deposition, you can actually build them in, and the stable structure should be reached directly as the H and metal items are deposited simultaneously, incorporating the vacancies in the appropriate proportions. You know, connecting the dots on this one I found very interesting. And in light of some of the results that we just heard about, you know, everything from ultrasonics to other forms of abusing the lattice, Chilani and his wire and the magic treatment he goes through to prepare it so that it will be successful. If you read what Pantelli has done and how he prepares his electrode, you know, by cycling with high temperature and vacuum and then hydrogen and then the cycle and high temperature, you know, and so on, you begin to wonder, are they in fact creating and ultimately loading superabundant vacancies? That's a suggestion. I don't know if that's the case. So, observations. You know, co-deposition has been used successfully by a wide variety of experiments. We don't know, you know, what's the role of the magnetic or electric field, but clearly they are important. And different protocols, here's an interesting suggestion. Can different protocols lead to different reaction paths? Is there a heat protocol? Is there a particle protocol? And that has been suggested. Was the Flashman-Pons experiment really a co-deposition experiment? And Peter's the one that suggested this, I believe, that did enough palladium come off of the rod, off the palladium wire, and they get redeposited so that it became a co-deposition experiment, and that's why it took a long time for the loading. Subject of good discussion. What are the role of superabundant vacancies? And were Flashman and Pons lucky with their protocol? You know, the phrase you used that Flashman and Pons experiment might be considered a bad experiment based on this. Quite not putting words in your mouth here, co-deposition produces both high surface area and SAVs. So this raises a question, are SAVs involved in the gas-loaded nanoparticles? So far, the main thing I've learned by studying this is that there are a lot more questions. I'm learning a lot more things that I don't know rather than what I do know. So once again, I'd like to acknowledge Mitchell Swartz and the team. I know didn't do it all alone. Stan Spock and Pam Mosier Boss and the Spay War team who supported me for a long time since I was on overhead and they were trying to earn or pay direct funding. Dennis Letts and Peter Hagelstein who collaborated and answered a lot of questions, were patient with my questions. And then finally to all of you, or contribute and continue to work in this field. Thank you.
Frank, very nice. Two questions. One, in addition to loading, things loading has knowledge, you need a flow. And you haven't said anything about that. what do you know about it? Second thing is the picture you showed, missions and sparklers and so on, other things. You would think that these reactions are taking place in small regions, whereas this SAB looks like a uniform loading. You shouldn't see small regions, small hotspots.
The question is, you know, does co-deposition produce a full, complete complement of vacancies? And, you know, there was even a, Fukai even gave it a name, H3, back something or other, something for, rather than the FCC name for the president. So the question is, what is produced there? How many vacancies are produced? I think Peter's got either a question or an answer. I'm hoping for the latter.
Briefly, the idea is that if we have hydrogen around palladium, nickel, or other metals, with every additional hydrogen nearby, it stabilizes the vacancy. It's roughly 2/10 electron volt for hydrogen or deuterium in the vacancy. So if you get a loading with palladium in your room temperature of about 0.95, the vacancy becomes more stable than having the palladium there. The only thing is that room temperature doesn't load. So what Fukai does is he raises the temperature to have things diffuse to make the phase. The thought about co-deposition is when you're co-depositing the metal, you're making the phase. So the co-deposition naturally will produce the lowest energy state. So if you co-deposit slowly, palladium comes on slowly, but at high current density, and the loading very high, you get conditions under which you stabilize the vacancies. So you co-deposit lots of vacancies. So that's what Dennis was trying to do.
An historical comment, Peter will immediately correct. There was a Pons, right after Fleischmann Pons. Pons reported in an interview with a Nature editor that he tried light water and he found excess heat. That was only Pons immediately afterwards. And Nature reported that finished off cold fusion. But it doesn't finish it off if the reactions involve heavier nuclei and I'll stop.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Thank you.